You're listening to the Electric Sheep Magazine podcast. I'm Alex Fitch, and in this special Halloween episode, I'm talking to three directors who have all made films about man's relationship with the land. In a Q&A recorded at the East End Film Festival, I'm interviewing Stephen Eastwood, co-director of Buried Land, a mockumentary-stroke-docudrama about the real-life discovery in the small town in Bosnia of an ancient buried pyramid, which may reinvent mankind's knowledge of pre-Christian architecture and empire building, but in the short term has changed the fortunes of the people in the area. And then finally in today's show, I'm talking to Robin Hardy, the director of the classic horror film The Wicker Man and the new belated sequel The Wicker Tree, which, like the original, is a film about fertility and terrifying pagan rites. First of all, I'm talking to American actor and director Larry Fessenden about his eco-themed monster movies, No Telling, Wendigo, and The Last Winter.
You spoke eloquently on stage about how you had a love of classic horror films as you were growing up, both the RKO ones and then in the 60s, stuff like Night of the Living Dead. But as well as an interest in those classic horror tropes, something that's very prevalent in your movies is your anger about how man is destroying our environment.
Yeah.
What sort of experiences in your formative years created that anger as you were becoming an adult?
I'm not impressed with people who put on airs, and I just think the whole humanity has that element. I had a great passion for thoughtful and eccentric people. I went to a really cool school when I was young, and I thought that that was the way of the world. And then as I went out into the world, I saw that so many people were faking it, and they were ingenuine, and people would call the name of religion in the false way. And I think so it's an anti-authoritarian thing. And then I grew up going to Cape Cod and just liking nature, respecting it. I'm not an outdoorsman. I just believe in respect for your elders, and there's nothing older than the earth, you know. Although some in America would question that, too.
But also, I guess, in films like No Telling, there's also the way that humanity is actually manipulating evolution against, you know, our own survival. When it comes to presenting that on film, horror is a very good way of doing it. But how do you keep that sense present without it being just the message of a film?
Well, some people would feel that I do preach, at least in No Telling. I think things got carried away. But it's funny, there's a central scene where they're arguing at a dinner table. And my point in that scene, while I think the casual viewer sees it as preachy, trying to get two ideas out, I really see it as how we can't communicate. You go to parties and people do talk about politics, and you walk away and you realize you can't change minds. I find that fascinating. So in a way, I try to have movies where there's some dialogue about a situation, but then there's a reality that you're showing cinematically, and that's the one that trumps it, because reality will trump all this conversation. And you can say something's not true, like global warming, but the fact is there's going to come a time when it simply is true, and then you have to deal with that. And that basic betrayal of our potential as a species, as an individual, is really what drives me. The movie Habit is about how that guy cannot rise above his alcoholism, cannot find his better self. And that's the tragedy of humanity, I really think. And so that's why my movies are personal, even though they have this veneer of these political issues. And if you deal with the environment, people will be defensive, because in our heart of hearts, every individual knows that we are part of the problem, and that I find also interesting and horrific. It's really what I love about horror, is it's the truth teller of the genres. I don't want to make political movies that preach about politics. I find that uninteresting, but I'd love to have a monster come along that's vindicating, nature.
Well, and I suppose the supreme example of that in your films is in Wendigo, which was the first of your movies that I saw and really kind of like grabbed me in terms of tracking down your earlier films, because it's very much about the myth of a creature out there that no two people can agree on what it looks like.
Exactly.
And it seemed to be very brave of you, actually, unlike a lot of filmmakers. I mean, partially, I suppose, because you said you were disappointed by the first monster that your effects team made, was that you will show that it looks different to many people. And I suppose to the audience that can be frustrating, but there's an honesty there as a filmmaker.
And also, I believe that if you show the monster different ways, you're getting at the essence of another theme that interests me, which is the subjectivity of reality. I mean, to one character in Habit, his girlfriend's a vampire. To the friends, she's an interloper and taking away his attentions from their party life. And then in the end, there's a very subtle thing where you realize that both stories are true. He's either fallen out the window alone or he's fallen out with her. So I love this slippery reality, and I believe in a very deliberate ambiguity in storytelling, because that is how life is. It's appalling sometimes when you talk to someone, you realize they hold a different view, and they are absolutely coming from a genuine place, and you realize it's so hard to connect. And it has to do with their upbringing and every other thing, every subtle thing that creates a human personality is in play. And I like to show that in movies. And I think the nature of horror is that it allows you to delve into issues of split personalities, unreliable narrator, an untrue a reality, a slippery reality.
And also the ambiguity of horror films, in a way that seems to be an antidote to the encroaching apocalypse that seems to be presented constantly in the news. You know, you spoke about the riots on the streets of London, which happened recently. But if, you know, society is going to collapse, maybe it's these communal myths that can bring us together again.
Well, that's also my business in my films. I'm trying to show not which myth to follow, but how important myths are to give us meaning. Because, in fact, otherwise, you're left with a very bald, a desperate reality that is amoral. And so I celebrate, and I want people to acknowledge, if you acknowledge that you are clinging to mythologies and that your worldview is formed for a reason, then you can at least get a window in someone else's, and there's some hope for... I really think the irony, the pinnacle would be to create a film that created a new paradigm for people to get behind. And that's why I'm trying to suggest that nature, in some way... It's funny, most people think my movies are about nature getting revenge and being threatening, but I'm saying have awe, have respect. I'm not really saying it's a baddie. But that's... You realize you can easily be misinterpreted when you're dealing with something so primal as our relationship to, you know, the rest of the world. That's why I'm not as interested in, like, the Exorcist-type films, because it's dealing with God and the devil, and I'm like, let's stop talking about that, and good and evil. Let's look at this whole other paradigm. So while I'm not going to single-handedly save the world, that is my preoccupation, to sort of put forth a new way of looking at our reality, and maybe if we could agree on that, then we could get to the business of saving ourselves.
Cool, thank you very much.
Thanks very much, man.
Larry Fessenden's excellent eco-horror film, The Last Winter, is available now on DVD in the UK, and you can find a review of the film at www.electricsheepmagazine.com. The director's older films, including Wendigo, No Telling, and Habit, can be imported from American DVD sellers such as Amazon.com. Next, here's my interview with the co-director of Buried Land, Stephen Eastwood. The film is a documentary-style drama in which a filmmaker goes to the small town in Bosnia where, in real life, a pyramid was supposedly found beneath the landscape of the local area. As neither the European Union nor the country have the money to do a proper excavation of the area, it's left ambiguous to whether the pyramid itself is real or an elaborate hoax created by the locals. Either way, the film that Stephen co-directed with Jeffrey Alan Rhodes is equally ambiguous in its approach to filmmaking, as we don't know how much of what we're presented is real, and how much actors improvising the kind of encounters you might expect to find, creating a kind of heightened reality surrounding the mythology that has grown up around the village.
In some respects, it's quite a difficult film to do a Q&A after, because I really like the ambiguity of it. So The more questions that I ask you and that you answer kind of destroys the mystique of the film.
Yeah, it's interesting. Some people after the screening want those questions answered, particularly, I mean, there's usually people that latch on to the pyramid aspect of the film, or they latch on to the filmmaking aspect of the film, and they want it debugged or unpicked. But
well, I mean,
we could all go if you don't want to.
Well, I suppose the pyramid aspect of the film, I could go on Wikipedia right now, and that might still not answer the questions I have, in a way. I suppose it's the kind of place you'd actually have to go there and almost make your mind up for yourself, unless the European Union wants to put a budget of like $40 million together to actually dig out the pyramid, so we might not ever know.
I don't even think the Pyramid Foundation wants that budget, in a way, because I think they can pull people in so long as it's ambiguous. But as soon as it's completely disproven, well, I don't know, actually. I think some people might go, you know, read in Time Out, oh, that's the town that thought it had a pyramid. You know?
Oh, so it is a fake then?
No. I don't know what... It's a question of what arouses you on the level of tourism, because I would personally be interested in going to that town, irrespective of whether it was true or not, because of what has happened to that town because of this story. But I, you know, during the production, lots of people would say to me, what do you think of it? You know, do you believe in our pyramid? And I never really gave an answer on that.
Okay. Because I'm not so interested, actually, about the pyramid. Because I think it's really interesting, in recent years, you're increasingly getting films that are scripted that are being shot in the style of documentaries.
Yeah.
Just this week, I did a Q&A, actually, after an Italian zombie movie.
Right.
That's been shot in the style of a documentary.
Right. And people came out of the cinema asking if it was real.
I suspect no one left the Gerber syndrome thinking that 10% of Italy has been struck down by a cannibalistic virus.
No.
But no, the filmmaking process, though, presumably some people did find that film offensive just because you went to Bosnia and made a film that dealt with a humorous subject that could possibly be seen as being making light of the people who live there, while there is the background of the history of war, the minefields, and so on and so forth.
I think it's a liberal kind of Western audience that has that opinion. It's not the opinion that we've received in the Balkans.
Okay.
No, certainly in Sarajevo, and we took the film back to the town. We screened in Sarajevo Film Festival, which was the Bosnian or Balkan premiere, and then we took it back to Visoko and screened it. A few people from the film were there, and we screened it to the community. And if that was, of course, the best test of it as a film, and we received no complaints, and there were lots of questions after Sarajevo screening, but nobody seemed to be offended. It was much more the case in Tribeca, where but what I tend to find with this film is that some people find it really troubling or offensive, and then somebody else has a very different opinion, and the audience tends to divide over it.
Well, because I wasn't offended by it, I don't want to imagine what might have offended me. What actually have people said that offended them about it?
Well, it's not just audiences. The research council that funded the research council was fine, but the ethics committee where I teach, because it was research council funded, the ethics committee sent me an 18 page letter breaking down how every single aspect of my research was unethical. But of course, if you think about it, filmmaking, especially documentary filmmaking, is unethical. Because you always have superior knowledge to the people that you are filming. As a filmmaker, you understand how you can manipulate that image. So it's very difficult to have an ethical filmmaking process.
Because I was going to say, there have been documentaries in recent years that I actually have found offensive, and it's been because of the techniques that the interviewers used. I'm thinking, for example, of Michael Moore in Fahrenheit 9/11, where he humiliates Charlton Heston. And yeah, Charlton Heston's an easy subject. He's a member of the NRA and he promotes gun culture, but he's a senile old man.
Yeah,
you know. And things like Werner Herzog in Grizzly Man, where he's talking to the wife of the guy who's had his head cut off by a grizzly bear, and he's manipulating her on camera, saying, you know, promise me you will never, never listen to this footage. And she goes, I promise you, Werner. And it's just horrible to watch.
Yeah.
And well, actually, with your film, I don't know how much of it was scripted and how much of it was purely documentary, but it doesn't feel like you're actually humiliating the people, just perhaps looking at the situation in a way that looks towards an ambiguous reading of what's going on.
Well, we had, you know, various checks and balances in place. One of the co-writers was from the town, fortuitously, and somebody came up to me having read this. I don't know if you've seen the screening notes, but there was a national magazine that ran this story saying that our film was going to do Borat in Bosnia. And this ran the week before, I think it was, Natalie might correct me, but we went into principal photography, so we literally landed in Bosnia with the sort of fallout of this article, and somebody came up to us and said, aren't you the person that's going to make fun of my country? And then we ended up hiring her to be our casting director, because we felt like the only way to really was to bring her on board and for her to sort of see our process and affect our process. So the number of people involved in the production on every level.
So how did that magazine article come about? It wasn't actually something that you did on purpose then to create that frisson when you arrived.
No, but it's impossible to really think of what the film could have been like without that accusation, because it really sort of glued everything together for us. It blew it apart in the short term, but then it gave us our real sort of hook and our narrative. I think a journalist, a bit of lazy journalism, had just read the website, and we announced we were going into principal photography and that we were working with one actor and everybody else was going to be the real people from the town, and they just they failed to reach us for an interview and said, well, you're obviously doing a Sacha Baron Cohen. And that was catastrophic for a while, because all the people, we'd been for various research trips to the town and built up this trust, and then that trust was lost and then regained. And then, of course, that forms part of the narrative.
Okay. Well, as we're here, let's dismantle the mystique. How much of it was scripted?
We had an 8-page treatment, for those of you that... The treatment is what you would normally write, and then you to develop and block down the structure of the story, and then you would write your script. But, of course, we knew that this character was going to be encountering his country as a returnee, and we knew that he was going to be investigating the pyramids, but also scrutinizing his own identity. And we knew that we were going to use real people, the farmer and the mayor and various people, to reflect and, you know, provide information. But we weren't going to put words in these people's mouths. So there was no dialogue script. So when he speaks to the imam, that's really a couple of leading questions that I'd prepped him on. A lot of improvising, a lot of me walking into the shot, just in such a way that people didn't always realize we were filming. They understood that we were making a film and that it wasn't a documentary. But I was able to sort of micro direct.
But the people he was talking to, did they know he was an actor or not until after you'd wrapped the film?
They absolutely knew he was an actor.
Well, then, as far as I'm concerned, that's not immoral.
No, I mean, I don't think that we crossed any ethical lines. Everybody was completely aware of what was going on. And various people got on board and became more and more immersed in that. Avdia, for instance, the sort of female lead, was really a tour operator, and we were able to, in conversation with her, develop this romantic storyline that she participated in. And now she's starring in a Malaysian Bosnian soap opera.
Because also, presumably, for the people taking part in the film, it was interesting for them to talk to the actor so that they could have a conversation with someone who would act as if they had returned to Bosnia, even if they hadn't actually done it. That might have been cathartic to a certain extent.
Yeah, I think the thing that's really important for me is that Visoko as a town, I think, was already performing. There was something that happened to that town that is bigger than I can understand or explain, and everybody had tapped into this collective, well, you can call it a myth, you can call it a project, whatever you want to have, whatever your opinion is about the pyramids, but everybody had sort of transformed around it. And so our film really just came in and sort of joined that momentum, that spirit. And so people wanted to sort of contribute or perform or act in to certain situations, and we didn't have to do that much sometimes. So often it was about sort of pulling it back rather than forcing performances. So a good example of that is, it's interesting because it's difficult to capture because we only had one camera and we shot like a documentary crew. So there's one scene which I'm not very satisfied with how we shot it, but I'm very pleased with the content, where Goran, the older sort of amateur archaeologist with the sort of Western moustache, is saying, nobody will find their happiness in the diaspora, and, you know, this is a warm stone. None of that was scripted. We had no knowledge that he was going to say that. He knew he was speaking to an actor, but he engaged somehow with this space that the film created.
Yeah. Well, I mean, that's what I'm talking about. It's drawing out an honesty from people in a cathartic way, even though the scenario to a certain extent isn't real.
Yeah. And I think that, I mean, a big sort of like reference for me is Kiarostami, and how in certain earlier Kiarostami films like Close Up, although I think Close Up has many ethical problems, but I'm interested in how Kiarostami created this place where you can't really separate out fiction from fact. People are sort of like playing in this sort of oscillating sort of space.
Your co-director, was he the other guy we see on screen, or was that another actor?
The other guy, the filmmaking character, is it's very important to stress that this film was sort of co-written and directed by Jeffrey Alan Rhodes, and we made a decision. Actually, the person that was going to play the
the kind of Warhol-esque kind of a Barnum sort of figure that we were going to work with pulled out at the last minute, so he stepped in. And so and we agreed that because he was in front of the lens, that I would call the shots on the set, but then every night we would sort of reflect on how the shooting had gone, and we were sort of completely together during the edit.
Well, and conversely, you would never be seen or heard.
I think you can hear my voice at some point in there, but obviously a lot of those things, like, you know, the radio interview, they thought they were interviewing myself and Jeffrey Allen, but we just said, well, can we just slip our fictional character in? Lots of situations like that. The big scene for me is the scene by the fire with Avdija, and she's talking to me in that scene. So when she's saying, you know, you're full of shit, basically, she was reflecting on that article that she had read way back before the shooting had begun, and I had asked her to respond to that because I knew that it would inform our character, but I knew she couldn't say it to him.
Presumably, the situation in the town where the actual nature of what you're coming to visit is ambiguous, whether it is a pyramid or it isn't a pyramid, kind of suggested the filmmaking technique that you're going to use. But in general, what do you think it is about this blurring of fiction and documentary that seems to be becoming very popular at the moment? I mean, in the last 6 months, there was Gareth Edwards' Monsters, for example, where you have a fictional couple going on a fictional journey in a fictionalized Mexico with very fictional monsters, but at the same time, they use real local people and ask them real questions.
Well, I think it's partly to do with technology and how... it's a little bit like revisiting sort of neorealist or nouvelle vague ideas, which really came out through lightweight portable camera technology in the 1950s and 60s. And now we're getting that portable camera technology again through digital forms. I think Gareth's film, they only had 3 or 4 people on the crew. So it changes the way you approach shooting. It makes a lightness of touch. And I think it invites improvisation. And, you know, I like to work this way. I would not have felt as comfortable just going in and making a straight documentary, because I think documentaries, unless you're making kind of poetic or sort of authored documentaries, inevitably have to sort of put over facts. To me, that's the wrong way of looking at the predicament, not the predicament, the kind of phenomenon of Visigoth. It's trying to sort of say that's true, that's false, that's true, that's false. It misses out on the slipperiness of it.
Well, and by editing it in a style that makes it look like an entirely scripted film, it adds perhaps a type of poetry that you wouldn't get in a traditional documentary.
Yes, although the film does change. I mean, we had 3 camera modes, so it starts out with this kind of handheld, fly-on-the-wall sort of approach, and then by the end you'll notice that the language is much more couched in the sort of fiction drama sort of vernacular.
Cool. Should we open it up to the audience? Does anyone have any questions for the co-director? Lady with a fantastic hat.
I just wondered, you talked about what you knew about the character of Vermeer. Did you know that before the whole Borat kind of idea came up? Was he your sort of solution, the fact that he was originally from that country and was revisiting? Was that your kind of way in to kind of, I don't know, dampen down any suspicions?
No. The character Vermeer came before the Borat accusation, and we, on our first research trip, we took a guy called Dalibor Stare, who had been teaching by who'd been a student by coincidence at Buffalo University, where I had taught. So he was a media student, but he had been relocated with his family from the neighboring town of Zenitsa to upstate New York when he was, I think, 19. As were many people when the war kicked off. And so he came back. I can't go away. Sorry, I'll talk to you briefly. He came with us as a translator. He came with us on this research trip as our translator and camera assistant. Only a few of us went, Jeffrey Allen and myself and Dalibor. And we were really struck by the changes which took place in him over this research trip, because he sort of arrived with this kind of swagger of, you know, I've grown into adulthood in America, and, you know, I'm sort of, I've got this different identity now. And by the end of the research trip, he was really saying, I really would like to live here. And, he was sort of like thinking about where is his home. And so that really sort of caught our attention as a way into this story, because of course we aren't Bosnian. We are always going to be creating a representation from the outside, and so we needed to find some kind of subtle but complex way of creating that story about outside representations. So this Dalibor became very useful to us, and then we just cast in Sarajevo, and as soon as we saw Emir, it was obviously going to be him. But we should say that the character Emir is played by an actor called Emir Kapitanovic. So again, we could play with that blurring.
Just following on from that, at the beginning, I thought, is he the interpreter, or is he part of the interviewer? And I actually found him so engaging, and because he was so connected to the country, I almost fell in love with him, and I became more interested in him. And I'm sorry to say, I almost felt like Alan was superfluous. I felt like any other interviewer almost didn't seem needed. And I'm interested to know why you needed to have, I know that's a bit controversial.
No, I think that's a fair point, but I think that, I'm watching it tonight, watching the filmmaker character, who we called Adam, actually. Geoffrey Allen, I should say. Everybody refers to him as Allen, so we're creating these sort of like slippages with names. And when he was running out of the final scene, I really felt like, well, he's just a device, and that's the point. He's not supposed to be in any way compelling or engaging or even believable. He's just a device, and maybe that's somehow a bit of a cop out. But you know, we knew that we couldn't write ourselves out of this story, that, you know, we were constantly confronting how on earth do you represent or film this town without having deeper knowledge. A bit like Avdir at the end says, you know, you never have the right pictures because you never stay here for long enough. We were commenting on that whilst still being guilty of it. So we needed a character in front of the camera that is pointless, a little bit irritating, not quite believable, and ultimately not that interesting or interested. And so, in fact, he was going to disappear in a hot air balloon, and we had a hot air balloon. We lined up you can get a lot of things in Bosnia. We got a free hot air balloon, and he was literally going to get this great aerial shot, the character, and then just drift away, and you wouldn't see him again. But we had bad weather for the 2 or 3 days that we planned to shoot it, so we never got that shot, so we just made him run off. But yes, he is a device, and you are supposed to be engaged purely with Emir. Not everybody does engage with Emir. Some people feel like, get this character out of the way, I want to know more about the town and the pyramids. So that's what I mean. Different people react differently to what's on the screen.
Anyone else?
Having seen some rough cuts earlier on, I just wonder how much of this story evolved in the editing process, and you actually created the story from a kind of palette of ideas that you gathered together from the shooting process.
Alice, do you want to answer that? I bet you don't, do you?
That'd be in there.
No, Alice did a fantastic job editing this film, and but I would say that I don't think the story was particularly shaped in the. I mean, it was nuanced. It was very much nuanced in the edit, but in actual fact, given that we shot, I think, 85 hours of material, we didn't have that much to work with. We really didn't. It wasn't as though we could suddenly decide to take the character off in different directions. It was pretty much set that, you know, we loosely based the story on a couple of like very simplistic fairy tales. The main story is the story of the Stone Soup, which is that two weary soldiers that were shattered from the war wander into this town very hungry, and they ask for food, and everybody in the town is impoverished from war, and they say, we haven't got any food. So the soldiers say, well, we'd like to make some stone soup. And can you get us a big cauldron and a fire? And the people of the town do this. And then the soldiers put the stones in and the water, and they heat it up. And they say, you know, carrots are really good in stone soup. Have you got any carrots? Or potatoes would go really nicely in this stone soup. And in the story, the people of the town understand that they're being tricked, but they go along anyway, because at the end of the day, everybody's going to eat together. And that was really our very loose storyline, which was two people wander into town. They trick people. The people of the town realise they're being tricked. They don't care because it's fun, and they you know, they've got an open heart. And we were trying to sort of also reflect on this archaeologist character, who's kind of this sort of Merlin type character in the film that you don't really get to know. But he is also a returnee. It's important to say Osmanagic made his money in Texas and he's only gone back to Bosnia in the last couple of years. And he's got so much charisma and so much drive that he's galvanized this town. And everybody's following him, but they don't necessarily believe in the project, but they understand it has economic potential or cultural potential. It's very difficult to know who really believes and who doesn't. So that story was set, we couldn't change it. We had a character that was encountering various people on his journey. And all we could do was sort of cut certain scenes or rearrange certain scenes to make that story move in the right direction.
Thank you very much. I thought it was a terrific film. And
thank you.
I think a lot of the audience would agree with me.
Thank you very much. Thanks for coming. Thank you.
If you'd like to find out more about the film Buried Land, including future screenings and DVD releases, please visit the website www.buriedland.com. Finally, here's my interview with Robin Hardy about his new film The Wicker Tree, which had its UK premiere at Frightfest just before I recorded the interview with him in the foyer.
This belated thematic sequel to The Wicker Man seems to have arrived at a very prescient time in terms of the script. Young people are being radicalised by religion. There's been a nuclear disaster in Japan, and your script references presumably the Windscale disaster in Scotland. Do you think these were kind of positive coincidences that helped the production of this film the way that perhaps the making of the original Wicker Man is supposedly cursed?
I think, well, coincidence, yes. But they happened after the script had been agreed and the book had been written and the film had been largely made. So I think the nuclear thing in Japan, you could say, is fortuitous.
For the film, anyway.
Yes, for the film. But, I mean, we had plenty of examples of water table being the disaster at Liverpool, you know, where lots of people were suing because they were infertile and so on. I think that's fair cop, really. And it's the sort of thing, since it relates to the sun, to the quasi-religious idea of solving the problem. I mean, in a way, I think it's a better problem to be solving than apples in the Wicker Man. But I think in lots of ways, I approach the film is one is to make it a really absorbing story. To do that, to create a number of characters with whom you either love or hate, you know, and to try and make it relevant to today with things like the nuclear, but also the religious zealotry of the American South, and the fact that we have rather given up religion ourselves in the United Kingdom, and that in a sense we and the Americans have drifted farther and farther apart and are continuing to drift, and this affects politics too. I mean, the Republicans are very much informed by religion. Democrats, thank God, less so. And we, I would submit, not at all. I mean, I don't think religion is a factor in British politics, Scottish or English, do you?
Well, I mean, talking of religious zealotry, it's only after, you know, he's fallen from office and people are generally referring to the likes of Tony Blair and, you know, George Bush as war criminals that he comes out as a Catholic, you know, which is almost a damning indictment of the religion.
Yes, I don't agree with you. But I don't think it makes Catholicism a political football as it was a bit in Kennedy's first election in the 60s, when it was very much so. And Kennedy really had to prove that the Pope's battalions weren't going to start marching down Pennsylvania Avenue, you know. I don't think it was that hard to sell. And I think the Catholics were on the right side, how can I say, of the God business as far as Americans were concerned, much more so than they probably are today.
You wrote the novel Cowboys for Christ that the film is based on in 2006. If that had only existed as a novel, presumably
getting the story out there was still something that was important to you. There was something about the themes of the original movie that you wanted to revisit. Were there any recent developments in history that inspired that, or was it just because the original had such a powerful story that you wanted to return to that in some kind of creative way?
I wanted to return to the genre more than the story. I mean, the story, I think, is powerful, but I think the genre, I mean, the use of humour, the use of songs, the use of eroticism as part of, you know, holding up a mirror to the pagan world was still of interest to me and remains of interest to me, actually. So I'm going to use it in the third film. So you could say that's a sort of leitmotif of the whole trilogy. And what attracts me is it's a vehicle which you can draw great characters and which you can pop all sorts of other incidental little arguments and sideshows, as it were, and I think make them seem relevant to your overall story. I suppose it could be said that The Wicker Man is a more direct story than this one. This one moves around a bit more in its arguments and its events. But here we're more involved with the character of the village than we were in The Wicker Man. And I think the Lord Summerall character as Lachlan, in the incarnation of Lachlan, is in some ways, I mean, maybe not quite as powerful as Lord Summerall was, but interesting in the sort of ambiguity of his conviction. And I enjoyed going into that ambiguity, you know, with the little boy by the bridge and everything, and I'm not knowing who they are. You're not really supposed to know who they are. They pay your money and you take your choice, really.
Well, one thing I thought was really interesting was that in the original film, having been made nearly 30 years ago, the clothes and the atmosphere of the time has now become somewhat nostalgic when we see it on screen. Yeah. And yet with this new movie, you've chosen a village that seems to have actually decided to remain in the past, what with Lachlan's car being made in the 1920s, the sort of classical clothes they all wear, almost as if not only does the desire to sacrifice people reinvigorate the fertility of the area, but they're somehow trapped in the past anyway, perhaps because of this conspiracy amongst the village people.
Well, I think it is because of the conspiracy that they're trapped. I think it is a little caught, but it's caught because it has this secret.
Yeah.
You know? And scenes between the policeman and Lolly, where he is trying to get at the secret. You're going to tell me about the cult.
Yeah.
In the book, I've obviously gone into that much more fully. But her treacherous betrayal of him, if you like, and yet her falling in love with Steve, there's another ambiguity which I like. I mean, I like ambiguous characters. You know, who aren't just heroes or villains, but have good parts and bad parts, sort of carrot egg characters.
And you spoke about Lord Lachlan being, in a way, the new incarnation of Lord Summerisle. And although Christopher Lee only has a small cameo in this film, his sort of malevolent presence is felt through a full sort of history painting style portrait that you have hanging in the family home of the ruling class of this village. That kind of presence of Christopher Lee's character, was that something that you envisaged from the outset? Was he happy to come back and do this as soon as you...
No, originally he was going to play Lachlan.
Okay.
But then he had this accident in Mexico. So, well into the beginning of the first shoot, we realised that we were not going to be able to use him.
Okay.
So I had to return to him literally a year later. And after we'd finished the main shoot and to design that sequence into the film, because I think people wanted to see him. They wanted to feel the connection with the original film. I did too, and That seemed to be a good way to do it.
And you said that you're working on a third film in the trilogy, The Wrath of God. What can we expect from that one?
Wagner. They're God also, yes, Götterdämmerung, exactly, yes. Have you met Keith Easdale?
No.
Our composer? Well, he's the person who wrote all these wonderful songs in the film we've just seen. And he's a very sophisticated musician. And we have all sorts of ideas for making a kind of carapace, as it were, of Wagner for the third film.
Okay.
But nevertheless, it will also jump about. I mean, there'll be an Andrew Sister kind of song. There'll be all sorts of different music in it. And it ends with the opera itself. It will end with the opera itself.
And a greater scale of apocalypse, or still a fairly kind of small scale?
A greater scale of it. I mean, a huge Wagnerian ending.
Fantastic. Cool. Thank you very much.
The interviews with Robin and Larry were recorded at this year's Fright Fest in London, and if you'd like to find out more about The Wicker Tree, including One Hopes its eventual wide release in UK cinemas, please go to www.thewickertreemovie.com. The Electric Sheep magazine podcast was recorded, introduced, and edited by Alex Fitch, and there'll be a new episode online next month at www.electricsheepmagazine.com/events. Thanks for listening.